Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a potentially seismic breakthrough in the treatment of heart disease.
And the storied history of the holiday TV special.
But first, the Phoenix Police Department's treatment of Tyrone McAlpin is now the subject of a lawsuit. Last month, he filed a $3.5 million claim over the incident, which drew national attention and criticism. McAlpin is a Black man who's deaf and has cerebral palsy. But in body cam video released earlier this fall, he's beaten and tased by Phoenix police officers after they pull into a parking lot where he was walking.
About 13th Street, maybe let's go.
Hey, buddy, stop where you're at. Have a seat. Tase him.
When McAlpin didn't respond, the officer jumped out of his vehicle and punched him. McAlpin's attorney said he couldn't hear their commands. Officers said he swung at them. The controversy came just 2 months after the Department of Justice found the Phoenix police use excessive force and violate people's civil rights. But our next guest says it wasn't a surprise. John Myers is executive director of the Arizona Developmental Disabilities Planning Council, and he says this all goes back to training. Here's our conversation.
I wish I could say I was surprised. You know, for all the work that's been done over the last 6, 8 years, maybe a decade, it is still too common for events like this to happen. We like to believe that progress is being made. We like to believe that law enforcement personnel are being better trained. We like to believe that there's more awareness of the fact that people have disabilities that are both visible and invisible, yet these things continue to happen. Mm-hmm. And we see response to individuals that is out of proportion to the danger they face and that is, in some cases, willfully ignorant, in some cases, innocently ignorant of the fact that disabilities exist or that that individual has a disability. And unfortunately, even when the disability becomes known, the response from law enforcement personnel is still too drastic and it's disappointing. It is disappointing. I wish I could say it was a surprise, but it is not.
Hmm. People with disabilities, we should say, are more likely to have encounters with police, it turns out. This is something I didn't know.
It's a fact. I shouldn't say that categorically. People with disabilities are more likely to have negative interactions with police. And part of that, again, is because certain disabilities are not evident at the outset, but it's also because law enforcement personnel, by and large, are just not well educated on how to interact with somebody who has a disability. Typically, the worst interactions are with those who have cognitive disabilities because those individuals are not able to necessarily process what they're going through when they're encountering law enforcement personnel. And so their response may be atypical. It may be unexpected. They may not know what to do. And in return, law enforcement personnel may not know what to do. Mm. And so things spiral out of control. Mm-hmm. It is truly unfortunate. But it points to the fact that we need to be, we as communities need to be better training law enforcement, and we need to be better educating individuals with disabilities about what law enforcement interaction can and should look like. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there are some programs that can help to do just that. Unfortunately, at this point anyway, it's almost impossible to make those programs available to everyone. But it's clear that at least on the law enforcement side, our communities need to be investing much more in educating police officers, sheriff's deputies, other individuals involved in law enforcement about what it looks like to interact with somebody who has Down syndrome or who has autism or who has cerebral palsy or who is deaf or who is blind or has some other disability that can hinder the way they interact in a typical fashion mm-hmm. with police officers or sheriff's officers.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about that. Because you head up the Arizona Developmental Disabilities Planning Council, you released recently this year a report on exactly this, right? Like on how police interact with people with disabilities, how we can improve that situation. Let's start with some of the obvious problems, right? Which is just training officers on how to even identify people with disabilities. Because as you say, many of them are invisible, particularly for those with intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Well, the training needs to start, of course, when they're in the academy, mm-hmm. when they're receiving their initial training to become an officer. There are programs that can help them. And I'm going to be clear from the outset. Not every disability is going to be evident at the outset of an interaction. We understand that. What we typically propose, what we typically ask for, is that law enforcement personnel, and they're trained to do this, I think, to some degree, that they proceed with caution, that they proceed carefully, and once a disability is known, that they respond in a way that's appropriate to that individual, that takes into account what that individual's disability is, that doesn't disregard the fact that there may still be some danger present, that the individual with a disability could perhaps have a weapon, could pose some other danger, but that they respond proportionate to the risk that's facing them. They need to have ongoing training. And this is one of the primary issues for those of us who are disability advocates, is that the ongoing training is absent. Hmm. Now, there are optional components. Sworn officers have to go through annual recertification. The Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Trainings Bureau has developed, in coordination with the Arizona Commission for the Deaf and the Hard of Hearing, some training modules that officers can take when they go through that recertification, but they are optional. Hmm. They're not mandatory. We would ask for mandatory training on an annual basis. We proposed this a number of years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. It was opposed and ultimately defeated by members of the legislature who felt that it was too expensive and or too time consuming for officers, that it simply wasn't necessary. It was basically that there aren't enough people involved. There aren't enough of these instances. But what we're finding, of course, is that these instances are happening far too frequently still.
How would you make that happen? Would this have to be a bill through the state legislature?
It could be a bill through the state legislature. That is the approach we took initially. It could also just become policy within AZ Post. It could become policy within local law enforcement agencies that they would include a module on working with people with disabilities. And I should also say that what training is provided, and there is, generally speaking, training provided on working with individuals with disabilities, but as the officer in the McAlpine case pointed out, the training he received was minimal, and he did not feel adequately prepared when he encountered that situation. That is the sentiment of law enforcement officers across the state. What they get is too little. It is not reinforced on an annual basis, and they feel unprepared.
And this is touchy, right? Like, because as you mentioned before, it's not like someone who has a disability is maybe not going to pose a threat. That has to be a part of the conversation, I wonder if it is.
It absolutely has to be a part of the conversation. We would never say all individuals with disabilities pose no threat. We certainly would never say that. And by the way, I want to really state categorically, we understand the dangers that law enforcement personnel face in their daily work. We're not in any way seeking to diminish that or disregard that. We understand that it's just a fact of life for them. It's a part of the job, and we respect them for that. What we would ask is that when they understand that a disability is present, that their response is proportional to that, to the danger that's faced. It is appropriate to the individual with the disability. And that can only come with better education about what different disability diagnoses look like. And to that end, we would ask that the training be expanded, that it be broadened, that it offer more information to them so that when they face those situations and they become aware that that disability is present, they know much better than they do today how to respond to it.
All right. John Myers, Executive Director of the Arizona Developmental Disabilities Planning Council, joining us to talk about this. John, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from another point of view on this story. The head of the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, who is in charge of what training police in our state undergo.
It is, as the old song has it, the most wonderful time of the year. But amidst all the jingle belling and good cheer, for some, it's also a season of anxiety, particularly when it comes to family gatherings. There's the awkward political conversations, the awkward career conversations, the awkward romantic conversations. And then there are the more serious conversations, like how to interact with loved ones who are living with dementia. Karen Von K knows this anxiety well. When her mother was diagnosed with dementia, Von K became her primary caregiver. And for 7 years, she was flying by the seat of her pants. She did the best she could, but as she puts it, she didn't know what she didn't know. After her mom passed away, Karen decided she didn't want anyone else to go through what she went through. She went online and discovered an organization called Dementia Friends. Now she volunteers as what Dementia Friends calls a champion. Von K does free trainings with caregivers to help them understand dementia and how they can integrate better with the person they're caring for. As she told me recently, a lot of what she teaches people is how to be good company.
What I really was missing was I didn't know how to communicate with her to make the best possible experience for both of us. I have learned now that we have to try and figure out what time zone our loved one is living in. And that might be back 30 or 40 years ago. And what would have helped then was to know that so that I could have engaged her in conversations about things and just relax and let her go with the flow. Whatever she said that she remembered might not have been the facts, but that really did not matter.
I see. So was there anything that you did instinctively that you have since discovered was a good and productive practice?
I never told her she was wrong about anything she said. Sometimes I would acknowledge what she said. If she asked me to do something or get something, I would repeat back, "I understand that you want," and then repeat it, "I can't get that right now," and maybe distract her with something else. Let's go for a walk in the garden.
That makes me think about what you were alluding to earlier, this idea that something that can be very valuable in an interaction with someone who's suffering from dementia is to, it sounds like, almost try to time travel to the moment you think they're in and operate from there.
You are so right about that. You know, you have to be who the person thinks you are at that moment. You know, there is an example close to the end of my mother's life. I was visiting her in the dining room at the assisted living place, and she thought I was her mother. And I somehow knew to just go along with the program. And I tried to be kind and gentle and understanding because she was so fragile at that point.
Yeah. You know, Karen, I'm so struck by what you're saying because in situations in my own life where I've been with a relative who has dementia, I didn't have the tools that you're describing and sharing right now. And the experience for me of recognizing that my grandfather, say, didn't know who I was or didn't know who someone was distressing. But if I'm hearing you right, if you can just get over the mental hurdle and meet them where they are, that distress will kind of fade because you'll notice that your grandparent in this scenario will become less distressed because they won't feel like you're challenging their sense of reality.
Exactly. Fixing and correcting are not options. The biggest thing that I emphasize, among many other things, when I do my Dementia Friends session is how we make our person feel. They may not remember the conversation, but you have been warm and friendly and loving, and that's what they will remember. Even if you have to perhaps do what we call a therapeutic lie. For instance, she could be asking, you know, where's John? John was her husband, and he died 10 years ago. Why not say, John's not here right now. Let's go have a cup of tea. You see, because if we told her the truth, he's dead, don't you remember? She's going to be upset that she did not remember.
Right.
And she's going to grieve all over again.
Yeah. You know, this makes me think that if that person is already dealing with reduced physical capacity, confusion, and difficulty moving around, interacting with things, if you are creating a difficult or upsetting emotional situation, you're just taking a bad situation and making it worse. Whereas if you just focus on trying to provide a warm, comfortable emotional interaction, if nothing else, it'll be some measure of relief from those physical challenges that they're having to navigate all the time.
It's important too, especially over the holidays, to be thinking about how you will deal with things with your loved one when you have family and friends coming in. Persons with any form of dementia experience a much smaller world. So when you get all these people coming in and there's a lot of fuss and noise and music and glasses and dishes clanking, it can be upsetting for them. So, you know, we try to advise that maybe you consider having another room where two or three people can go in and visit with your loved one and sit down and have a conversation away from all the noise and fuss.
I would also have to imagine that the holidays are a time when emotions are running more highly, particularly maybe for the family members who don't have dementia. What is your advice for those family members as they move towards holiday interactions where they might be seeing a family member with dementia for the first time in a long time, maybe?
I would advise either sending them an email or a letter or picking up the phone and having a conversation, letting them know that you're really looking forward to having them come for a visit and mom is really going to be happy to see you. If she has changed physically, you might want to send a picture so the people coming will not be shocked, and reassure them that what the doctor said is that she is getting the correct care, but these changes are part of the normal progression of the disease.
One other thing I wanted to ask you about here, Karen, is what are the best ways to support someone in your family who doesn't have dementia but who has been doing a lot of that really heavy lifting in terms of caring for a person with dementia?
That is such a tremendously important question. You know, caregivers, especially caregivers of persons with dementia who don't take care of themselves, are highly inclined to predecease the person that they're caring for. Hmm. So it is very important that they take care of themselves while family and friends are around. This is an opportunity to ask one of them to help you take care of your loved one for an hour or two so that you can take a nap, take a shower, watch TV, do what you need to de-stress.
Well, you know, I feel like a major theme in this conversation, Karen, is there's not really anything any of us can do to reverse the effects of dementia or change the reality of dementia. But if we just acknowledge some of the defining factors that dementia is going to impose on our families, there is a way that we can live with it in a little bit less distressing way.
Yes, we want to make sure that the person that we're caring for has the best possible quality of life.
Well, thank you for sharing these practices of just really deep listening and awareness. Karen Von Kay works with Dementia Friends USA. She's a board member of the Northern Arizona Alzheimer's and Dementia Alliance. Karen, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, and have a wonderful holiday. And remember, it's the disease, it's not the person.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the evolution of the beloved musical holiday special.
But first, it is time for the next edition of our series featuring local creatives and makers made in Arizona.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings. I try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
Today, meet Brianna Holland, owner of Creative Sunshine Boutique and evangelist of a certain kind of jewelry with a long cultural history, waist beads. The delicate strands of beads hail from Africa, where they can be used as a rite of passage for adolescent girls, a tool to track weight gain, or a way to promote spiritual well-being and sensuality. And they're meant to be permanent. For Holland, they can be used as all of the above. She teaches classes now to teach other people how to create their own waist beads. Her next workshop is this weekend, and I spoke with her more about it and how she discovered them.
So I went to a women's retreat back in, I want to say, 2018, and I met incredible ladies there. They were showcasing all kinds of things there, but specifically a lady was teaching me about waist beads, and I thought it was very unique, very, you know, amazing to understand like different types of culture within Africa, because there's so many countries. So she gave me a little education about it, you know, and I was like, you know, I think I can do this myself.
Okay, so describe these for us. You have some here that you've brought. This is permanent, right? Like this is something you make, and it's something that you fit to the person, and it doesn't come off.
Correct.
Okay. So you've got a ton here. Describe some of your favorites for us.
Okay. So actually, I thought about this earlier and I was like, which ones are my favorite? So I was going to keep some for myself because I never make myself waist beads. I usually just make them for my markets. So as I'm untying them, I usually do like a bundle.
Yeah.
And so some have like larger crystals in the middle.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And then intricate little designs. Some of them have glow-in-the-dark beads, clay beads, glass beads. So this is probably like one of my favorites. It has amethyst on it.
Mm.
It's really like dainty, but it's not going to poke you in your sleep.
What makes it permanent?
So there's the ends. You just tie it and burn it.
And burn it. Okay.
Yeah.
So there is a specific way to get them off at some point. But the idea is, right, that you wear them until they kind of fall off.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Why?
So there's specific ways or reasons why you wear a waist bead culturally, spiritually, aesthetic-wise, or weight loss-wise, or weight gain. So when you put it on, you're beginning a journey. And that journey, however long that is, that's when your waist beads break, when your journey is done.
Yeah. So you put them on sort of with, it sounds like, maybe like an intention.
Yep. So all kinds of intentions can go into your waist beads. I personally only provide like a positive intention, and I allow people to impart whatever type of intentions they want for their beads. Some people have asked me to bless them before they put them on, and I was very taken aback and very like, thank you for asking me, you know. It was really beautiful. There's so many aspects to waist beads, but you know, they started 3,000 years ago.
Yeah. So let's talk about the history a little bit, because you've really found out about this and teach about it now as you teach your classes for people to make them themselves. You discovered these, it sounds like, when you were discovering your own heritage.
I was discovering them, just coming into my more feminine side, and you know, learning through that. Obviously, I know like some of my heritage, but I don't think we all know exactly like what makes us. So I did a genealogy years later and found out, okay, I have like 26% Nigerian heritage. I'm like, oh, that's amazing. So I'm looking and researching. These are the beads that are in Nigeria. And the history is, you know, women would put their beads on their children when they're reaching fertility. Before that, they would make sure their children are growing, so they put waist beads on them then, and boys and girls get them.
Because it measures. So there's like a practical aspect, but also almost like a spiritual aspect sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yes. Is it spiritual for you?
I think it is. I feel like it should be. But I also, you know, have people do whatever they want to do with their beads. So if they want to wear aesthetically, then absolutely, you know, that's fine. But for me, spiritually, yes, I'm starting a journey, or I want to have like something come about. You know, I'm imparting my intentions and I want to see some fruit from my efforts.
Yeah. And it kind of gives you a way to, I guess, measure that, right?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about the impact that these have had on you. It sounds like this was about acceptance of your body for you, but also about, like you said, like discovering your own sort of femininity.
Yeah. So it was, you know, something that was in the culture to make sure that you understand your body and that, you know, you're, I guess, respecting yourself, providing that spiritual aspect to it. For me, I have worked really hard to accept myself no matter what I look like. And this also helped to like confirm it for me. So no matter what, you know, it's like a little lingerie, you know, you go home, you're like, oh, this is so pretty. And like, oh, I have to love my curves. I have to love this, because if I don't love it, then how can I expect someone else to love it, you know?
So when women come to the class and they want to learn how to do this, do they have any idea what it is?
Some of them do, but most of them, I would say half don't. So it's okay. I teach them.
Okay. What kinds of reactions do you get from folks?
There's a range. I feel that you can see the people who are interested in waist beads or who know about them or wore them. They're just super excited to figure out what kind of creation they're going to make. And then the other people, they're like, I don't know if I have creativity in me to pull it out, to figure out what design. So you get the range of, you know, super excited to kind of timid. And it's really encouraging to see like how the waist bead class does help them to build up their confidence, to build up the creativity and pull it out of them.
Okay, so they're permanent, as we said. You wear them all the time. Mm-hmm. How long do they tend to last? How long do these kind of journeys, as you describe it, last?
I would say the journeys last anywhere from, you know, I've had a waist bead put on one day and the next day it broke.
Ah.
I was very shocked. But, you know, they can last for up to years. I've had some on for like 4 years now.
Do you wear more than one at once?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
Some people don't, but I do.
And under your clothes, over them, et cetera?
Yeah, it just depends on like the feeling I'm having. So there are some waist beads that are specifically made just for your partner to see and no one else. And so I will be getting married pretty soon. So I'm going to create like my own personal set for my husband. And those are not going to be seen anywhere, like throughout my clothes or anything. It's just going to be underneath, you know, something very private. But the ones that I have currently, they are like, you know, on top of my clothes sometimes, depending on the outfit, or under, you know, if I want to just keep it modest.
That's really interesting. Congratulations, by
Thanks.
The way. So can anyone wear them? Is this something specific to a culture, a place, a type of person?
I think how I answer this usually to other people who are like not Black or African is that everyone can wear them. Everyone can share a part of this culture. I feel like African culture is very open, sharing and giving. And that's the type of mentality that I want to create with everyone. Like, hey, you're welcome to be a part of this. And I hope that you love yourself, you know, throughout this process too.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Brianna Holland, owner of Creative Sunshine Boutique, joining us to talk more about waist beads. Brianna, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. For decades, there has been a controversial debate over the benefits of taking fish oil as a nutritional supplement. But now, one University of Arizona professor thinks we may be getting close to a definitive and surprising answer. Dr. Floyd Chilton is the director of U of A's Center for Precision Nutrition and Wellness. Precision nutrition is a cutting-edge approach to dietary research, which looks at nutrition through the lens of evolutionary biology. By using more robust variables like genetic information, precision nutritionists believe they can pinpoint hyper-effective treatments for conditions like heart disease that previous studies may have missed. I spoke with Dr. Chilton recently about his groundbreaking research into the benefits of fish oil supplements.
It was said early on that nothing makes sense in biology unless in the light of evolution. And in particular, precision nutrition is around food sources. So if you were a foraging population in Africa, what you would have been eating well before organized fishing and animal husbandry would have been very different than what you would have been eating in Northern Europe. For a long time, we've in the nutrition field have believed that one size fits all. And typically that one size has been built around studies in European ancestry populations.
That brings us to this very remarkable analysis that you did in 2018, right? There was a 5-year clinical trial on the benefits of various nutritional supplements that was released. And initially the data seemed to suggest that there was not a clear benefit from, in particular, taking fish oil. But then you reanalyzed that data with greater precision, and you got a very striking result.
Yeah, you know, a study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018. 26,000 people followed over 5 years. The bottom line was that fish oil had no benefit for cancer or cardiovascular disease. Well, when we went back and looked at the study, there were 5,100 African-Americans in the study. And we had complete data when it became publicly available for 3,766. We could then match those African-Americans. We had over 16,000 European-Americans or non-Hispanic whites, and we could match them for covariates. And then we could resimulate the clinical trial using machine learning algorithms.
I see. So if am I correct that you looked at this data set and realized that there was an opportunity to rerun it in a way that would correlate a larger number of factors?
Yeah, we call it in science balance the covariance, but that's just a fancy smancy word for saying, you know, the age, BMI, a degree of heart disease, degree of diabetes, medication. So we could match 3,766 African Americans with 3,766 whites with all the covariance matched and then rerun the clinical trial. And what our study indicated was an 83% reduction in heart attacks or myocardial infarction in the African American population, but no effect in the white population.
That is an astounding number. 83%?
It is astounding. And it was astonishing to us. I think what's really important about this work is we must identify the populations in which interventions are going to work.
Yeah. But if I'm hearing you right, it sounds like to get to that point, we have to start introducing the value across the field of the type of studies that you're doing, acknowledging the idea that there may be genetic factors in some populations and not others, that if focused on, we have the opportunity to discover these things. But that it seems like the first step there is acknowledging as a discipline the importance of taking these things into consideration, right?
Absolutely. And we must, because evolution was different for all of these populations. And then we must include them in our clinical trials.
Yeah. Now, I believe that this result that you got when you reran the analysis, while it was startling, it did match up with your suspicions about the potential benefits of fish oil amongst African Americans when it comes to heart disease. What gave you that inkling?
In 1961, the American Heart Association said, saturated fatty acids are bad. Eat PUFAs, eat polyunsaturated fatty acids. We instantly went from 1.5% of our energy as PUFAs to almost 10% of our energy as PUFA. And we did that because it was reducing cholesterol and cholesterol esters in non-Hispanic whites. The assumption there was that would benefit everyone equally.
So I know that heart disease is a huge concern in the African-American community. And hearing a result like this that sounds like it has just life trajectory altering potential, is that what we're talking about here? Something that could like completely rewrite the story of heart disease in the African-American community?
I want to emphasize potential because I don't want... I'm not a physician. I have a PhD in biochemistry, and I study genetics, and I'm an evolutionary geneticist. So I want to emphasize I'm not an MD.
Right. And this is not necessarily a segment designed to encourage people to run out and buy a bunch of fish oil.
That's right. But if we are correct, we're recently funded with a $4 million grant from NIH, and if at the end of this 5 years of this that we're stratifying by ancestry in this trial, and we're stratifying by genome characteristic. And then we're giving fish oils to non-Hispanic whites and African Americans. Now, if we come back with a large-scale clinical trial focused in particular at African Americans, then there's tremendous potential because you can drink milk or not drink milk, right. But you cannot get these polyunsaturated fatty acids out of your diet. They're in our cooking oils. We have no choice but to eat them.
Right.
I would say this, our work is controversial. There's been a controversy in this field between the epidemiologist and the basic biochemist and geneticist, mm-hmm. such as myself.
Yeah. Well, what is that controversy? What is the, in the epidemiology community, what are their objections to your work?
Well, you know, in 1961, there was this recommendation by the American Heart Association. It's been doubled down upon. Mm-hmm. Several times. You know, my plea is we must understand these recommendations, whatever they may be, in diverse populations. In populations where their evolutionary genetics or the evolutionary pressures were dramatically different, we must get more sophisticated because one size fits all does not fit all. And that's the take home of this message or this study.
Yeah. Well, some potentially very exciting developments to follow over the next few years. I've been talking to Dr. Floyd Chilton, who is a professor at the U of A School of Nutritional Sciences and Wellness and the director of U of A's Center for Precision Nutrition and Wellness. Dr. Chilton, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. This is the time of year when a particular parasitic plant gets a lot of attention and is even brought into some of our homes. If we've learned nothing else from Christmas movies, we know that people accidentally end up under a sprig of mistletoe at a holiday party and then have to kiss and then end up living happily ever after, of course. Many of those movies are set in places where those holiday parties happen during a lovely Christmas time snowfall. But there is a type of mistletoe for us desert dwellers, too. My co-host Mark Brody spoke with Kelsey Yule, project manager for the National Ecological Observatory Network Biorepository at Arizona State University. More about it last year.
So desert mistletoe is a species of mistletoe that is located across the entire Sonoran Desert and a little bit of the Mojave Desert, so into California, but across, you know, obviously found across all of our southern Arizona habitats at the lower elevation where we see that desert scrub. So mistletoes are parasitic plants that grow up in the canopies of their host trees. Desert mistletoe infects the legume trees in our region. So most commonly that would be the mesquites or the palo verdes, the ironwoods.
What does it look like?
So it actually looks a lot like the mistletoe that we think of as part of the holiday season. It's a green clump up in the tree canopies, and it produces a lot of reddish or whitish berries, like we think of with the Christmas mistletoe. But unlike the typical or stereotypical Christmas mistletoe that, you know, grows in Europe or in the eastern United States, it does not have big leaves. So it looks a bit more stringy than the typical mistletoe, but it's a big clump up in the canopy of our most common trees here in the desert.
How common is it? Like, is this the kind of thing where, like, if you just look up and know to be looking for it, you'll probably see it? Or is it less common than that?
It's very common. So it's not very often, like, in town or in the city, although you can occasionally see it. But it's very common, especially if you go out to desert washes. And it really, it just depends on where you find the seed dispersing birds mostly. It's our most common host tree species that it can grow on, and it'll be really patchy across the landscape, but kind of wherever you find its main seed dispersing bird, the Phainopepla, you can find the mistletoe.
So you mentioned it is a parasitic plant. Does it actually kill its host, or does it just take its water and some of its other nutrients?
It just takes some water and other nutrients. Generally, a parasite doesn't want to kill its host because it will die too. The mistletoe can't survive if it's not, right, tapped into the branches of a host tree. People often ask me about how to remove mistletoe from the trees in their yard. And my answer is always, if you love birds and pollinators and the native wildlife here in the Sonoran Desert, there's no reason to remove it. It doesn't have strongly negative effects on the host trees, and it's really an important food source for a lot of our wildlife.
Does desert mistletoe bloom this time of year? Like, is this the kind of plant that people might choose to cut down and put in their house around Christmas?
Yeah, so it is blooming around this time of year. The flowers are super small. They're like a millimeter in diameter. But they are quite fragrant, so that's nice. I think they kind of smell like spiced apple cidery, so that's very cool. But the reason why someone might bring it in is pretty similar to why they might think that the typical Christmas mistletoe is pretty. They do have these like beautiful red berries and tons of them on a single plant.
And as you said, it is fairly similar in many ways to other kinds of mistletoe, right?
Yeah. So the Christmas mistletoe is the same plant family, same origin. And the Eastern mistletoe that is often used here in the U.S. as the Christmas mistletoe is the same genus of plants, so very closely related.
Does this plant have a particular use other than the way that some people use it around this time of year?
Yeah, so the Seri and Autumn indigenous communities have long used the berries as food. And although all the green parts of the plant are toxic, the fruit are not, and they can often be kind of sweet. And one of the coolest things, I think, is that the Seri and Autumn people recognize that the berries actually taste different depending upon the type of host tree they're on, you know, mesquite versus Palo Verde versus acacia. And so certain plants from certain host trees are, you know, preferred for use as food.
That is really interesting that the, as you say, the parasitic plant kind of takes on some of the characteristics of its host.
Yeah, absolutely. And then for my research, I actually looked a lot at how the mistletoe was different depending upon what host it grows on. And we see some genetic differences there too. So it's really borne out on all levels how this mistletoe has adapted to its host species.
Kelsey, thanks so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Kelsey Yule is project manager for the National Ecological Observatory Network Biorepository at ASU.
Oh, by gosh, by golly, it's time for mistletoe and holly.
Lauren, do you have any holiday movie traditions in your family? Maybe It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Story. Perhaps you're one of those Die Hard is a Christmas movie sorts of families.
Definitely not. No, we're all about, I'm going to say White Christmas is number one. We've already watched it. What about you?
Excellent. Excellent. We're a Home Alone house. We always end up in a debate about how on earth that movie was rated PG, considering the amount of violence that befalls the Wet Bandits. But our producer, Athena Ankra, enjoys a different type of yearly holiday viewing.
As soon as we saw it for the first time, my mom and I knew we'd be watching the Jinx and Dayla holiday special every year for the foreseeable future. It's got it all. beautiful gowns, dynamic sets, original parody songs and jokes, and two talented drag queens who ooze chemistry and theatrics.
I got it. I can give you that perfect Christmas you never had.
It's just not something I ever wanted.
Well, I can give you that perfect Christmas you never wanted.
What? The thing about this special, self-produced in 2020 and starring Jinx Monsoon and Ben de la Creme, former competitors on the popular reality show RuPaul's Drag Race, is that it's a joyous departure from the typical holiday special genre. In the hour-long show, which you can stream on Prime Video or Apple TV, the two drag stars argue about how they should do the special that we're currently watching. De La is trying to put together a classic Christmas show based on family traditions and inspired by the ghost of her late grandma embodied in a talking glass of eggnog. But Jinx didn't grow up with any of the warm holiday memories or revered traditions.
Santa came to my house in a beat-up Chevrolet. He cased the joint, said, "What's the point?" And then he drove away.
It's all very sweet, with just a touch of sacrilege. I watched it again recently, and that got me thinking. Just what makes for a good holiday special? Of course, this question led me down a deep YouTube spiral. I watched several hours of programming from now all the way back to the buttoned-up, intimate, and super religious specials of the 50s and 60s.
Tonight on the Kraft Music Hall, the Mitzi Gaynor Christmas Show, starring Mitzi Gaynor.
Radio and TV personalities Perry Como and Mitzi Gaynor were among the first to do it, and all-timers like Judy Garland, Bing Crosby, and Frank Sinatra popularized it. You get a lot of fake living rooms with the stars and oftentimes their actual children inviting you in for a casual evening of music by the fireplace.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light.
As you'd expect, things got a whole lot looser by the 70s, when everyone and their barely famous dog had a holiday TV special. Some call it a golden age for this type of programming. We've got Johnny Cash, Andy Williams, Bob Hope, The Carpenters, The Osmonds, even that one bizarre but beloved Star Wars special. There's a special from this era starring John Denver that you might recognize. For the most part, the 70s specials are classic variety shows, leaning into comedy and aiming for a heartwarming, cozy feel overall. Not only are Sonny and Cher singing disco-ified Jingle Bells in their 1976 special, they're also doing little SNL-style sketches spoofing A Christmas Carol and Gift of the Magi, with Broadway legend Bernadette Peters and a baby Chaz Bono dressed up like an angel.
Sonny and Cher's Christmas Show. Hey, I wonder what she's going to give Sonny this year.
Last year she gave him the shaft.
The vibe of the holiday TV special has been pretty consistent ever since. You either have the comedy-oriented but sometimes cringy ones, or the super earnest but sometimes corny ones. But then there are those holiday specials that defy any category. In the late 80s, the lanky, bow-tied, squeaky-voiced alter ego of the late Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, took on the genre, and it's just about as fun and borderline hallucinogenic as you'd expect. And the guest stars?
Frankie Avalon, Charo,
the Del Rubio triplet,
Annette Funicello, Whoopi Goldberg, Magic Johnson, Grace Jones, Katie Lang, Little Richard, Joan Rivers, Dinah Shore, Oprah Winfrey, and Princess Zsa Zsa.
It's wild. At one point, a package addressed to the White House gets mistakenly dropped off at the Playhouse, at which point Grace Jones pops out and does a very Grace Jones iteration of Little Drummer Boy. The early 21st century brought the rise of what I'll call the anti-holiday special. Stephen Colbert and Bill Murray each did their own satirical deconstruction, and they take all of the typical components, fake snow, dancing Rockette-esque ladies, duets, celebrity appearances, and convoluted plot devices, and twist it into something new. Here's Colbert in his 2008 special explaining why he wrote original songs for it.
Don't get me wrong. I love White Christmas and Silver Bells and Puff the Magic Dragon. But I found out when you sing those old holiday standards, someone else gets the royalty check. That doesn't sound like Christmas to me. So instead, I'm writing all the songs like this one. Hit it, Jimmy!
Ho! It's another Christmas song.
And that same flavor runs through a lot of the specials of today. I love the Jinx and De La version because it plays with all of the kitschy, heartfelt fun that makes these specials shine in a way that's distinct from the movies or music. Is it high art? Of course not. But that's not why Mom and I come back every year.
The childhood festivities we once revered now as adults seem depressing and weird. So next year we'll find a tradition that's new and gay.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankra. Happy holidays.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you. Outside the snow.
I'm gonna have to check some of these out, Sam.
Yeah.
Sounds epic.
I want to get me some of that talking eggnog, too.
It's gonna be fun. All right, well, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram. It's at KJZZ, The Show. For Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.